All right, so this is the 9/11 and Other Deep State Crimes Teleconference for the 28th of November, 2018. Our illustrious Secretary Craig McKee could not be with us tonight, so he's asked me to call the roll clearly and distinctly, so we'll try it here and see how I do, and then hopefully it'll be there for his reference when he listens to the recording. So I've got so far Sherry Aspen, Barbara Honegger, Barry Zwicker. I have Bonnie Faulkner twice, so there's evidently something else going. I have her four times. Holy cow.
How many
Bonnie Faulkners are there? I thought there could only be one of her. Well, what's up with that? I guess everybody, Bonnie, are you on Skype by any chance?
This is why I've been fast.
What is
Bonnie, are you even here?
That's your last. What's your first name?
Okay.
There are two bots and no real Bonnie.
Yeah, I bet you those are all people that are here on Skype is what's going on. So we're going to have to go back and figure out who they are later. I have Kat McGuire, Charles Ewing Smith, Cheryl Curtis, Carl Golovin, myself, Ken Freeland, Lawrence Fine, Lynn Bradbury, Mick Harrison, P.F. Soto, Peter Ketchin, and Richard Krishnick.
Now, I can give you the other 10 names here if you like.
Well, by the 10 names, we want to find out who are the people that are calling in on Skype tonight. So if you call in on Skype and you didn't hear your name read, tell me who you are one at a time.
Oh, go ahead.
I'm Mike Springman. I'm calling in on Skype.
Want me to put in as Bonnie number one?
Well, wait a minute. You can't just do that, Clerk Cheryl, because these are separate people, so you have to see which one it is. So would you say again the first one who said that he's on Skype? Who's that?
This is Mike Springman.
Yeah. This isn't going to work. Okay, well, anyway, so we have Mike Springman. Who else did not hear their name mentioned?
James
Hufford. Okay.
James Hufford.
Okay, I got James Hufford. Who else?
John O'Malley.
Dwayne Dietz.
Okay, who else?
Marty Hopper. Yeah, H-O-P-P-E-R.
Okay, well, you're here. Okay, we got you. And who else?
Dan Hannon, Minneapolis.
Dan Hannon, okay. Anybody else whose name
Dick
was
Alley.
Not mentioned?
Dave Meiswinkle.
David Meiswinkle? Okay, got you, David. Thank you. And who else?
John O'Malley.
Nita Renfrew.
Yeah.
John O'Malley, okay. Who else?
Nita
Renfrew. Okay, who else?
Gregory Longo, but he's on my line, so it's
that's
not
okay.
One of
Gregory Longo, and also I guess Susan Serpa is on somebody's line as well, right? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Did you get Dick Atlee?
Yeah, I got you, Dick. Anybody else whose name I did not mention?
David Cole.
David Cole. Okay. And,
yep.
And anybody else?
Gilad Utzman,
of course. Gilad Utzman, yes, of course. So. Okay, anybody else whose name was not mentioned?
Well, I was off the line for a minute, and so I don't know whether my name was called Barry Zwicker.
Well, in case it wasn't, we are calling it now. So Barry Zwicker's here, and who else? Anybody else whose name was not mentioned earlier? All right, very good then. We will take that for the roll call for now. And we will move on to approving the minutes as posted by Craig earlier in the week. Any objections to approving the minutes as posted? Hearing none, then the minutes are approved, and we move on to consideration for tonight's draft agenda. Any objections to approving the agenda for your use tonight, the draft agenda circulated? Hearing none, then that will be our agenda for this evening, and that will take us to our first guest. Our special guest tonight, Gilad Utzman, and here to introduce him, I know, is Nita Renfrew. So, Nita, the floor is yours.
Hello, everybody. Have the honor to introduce my good friend Gilad Utzman tonight. He is one of the very courageous people that I have known in my life. And I have the way I met him was I followed his newsletter. I had spent 9 months in Israel after the 67 war. And when I started following Gilad's newsletter, I realized this is the first time I've heard anybody describe what I saw in Israel and what I came away with. And, of course, that's why he's very important. He hasn't ceased to speak truth to power. Eminent theologian Mark Ellis has called him a Jewish prophet and has said he gives the Jews no quarter. And this is a big compliment to Gilad. And he has never ceased to do that. He's just been involved in a lawsuit for slander because he's been criticizing Zionism and Jewishness and so on. And the lawsuit is no longer ongoing, but he's in the hole for a lot of money, so he deserves support. Any of you who can support him, that would be great. He is the author of several books. He started out writing novels, and he's also a world-class jazz musician. He doesn't have to write about Israel or about Jewish power or how they control things or anything. He could just be an artist, and he would have a much easier time in his life. But he's also a philosopher, and he's written two very important books. One is The Wandering Who, a study of Jewish identity politics, and the other, which is more recent, is Being in Time, Exploring the Post-Political Condition. And I recommend that people read the books together because they form... they complement each other. In the first book, he actually describes what, he gets into the whole idea of what Jewishness is, how it should be examined, and so on. And he talks very much about the economy that Milton Friedman introduced into the United States, which was a service economy, and how that has led to a lot of what's going on with the Jewish power in a very interesting way. And then in Being in Time, he talks a lot about the identitarian politics that have sort of taken hold of everything now and of the media and so on. And they come together in a very interesting way. So I recommend that you read both of those books. So, Gilad, we'd like to hear from you now.
Yeah, thank you so much. Nita, if I knew that this is how you're going to introduce me, I would make sure that my mom listens to the program as well. you mentioned, I think that some of you know, I was subject to a libel case here, which had to be settled, but it left me in kind of huge legal, with a huge leak. So I mean, the last few days I kind of had to get something like $60,000. So if you have any networks, you know, send them to my website, and people can help me on that front. But I must say that so far, kind of in the last 48 hours, a lot of people came forward, and we may even get there eventually. I would like to explore with you guys a theme from Being in Time. I would like to talk to you about controlled opposition, because I think that this is the most interesting idea I can contribute to you guys, because you all know more than me about 9/11 and building number 7. Obviously, I know quite a bit, but I won't be able to contribute anything new to you on that front. What I can do for you guys is to give you some elementary tools that will help you to detect interferences with your and attempts to deviate you from truth-telling or truth-finding, which is even more important. Okay, I start now. Quite often, Jews find out that people around them are pretty upset upset by different aspects of their culture. For instance, Jews quite often admit to themselves that some people blame them for capitalism, for banking, for Wall Street, for Goldman Sachs, for Rothschild, and so on and so on and so on and so on. Some Jews may admit to themselves that Palestine is a problem for the Jews, that a lot of people are upset by Zionist politics, by lobbying, by AIPAC, by Sheldon Adelson, by Chaim Saban, and so on. Some people within the Jewish community do accept that Jews are also being accused for liberal values, for cultural Marxism, Frankfurt School, identitarian politics. These are things that I really explored in my recent book, Being in Time. Many cases, Jews are blamed for the recent wars, for neocon wars, Zionist wars, the war in Iraq, the war in Syria, and so on and so on. Jews are often being accused of dominating the media. And, you know, you can talk about Jews being accused of Islamophobia, Pamela Geller, and so on and so on. What Jews do is that when they detect such an anger, they are very, very quick to form what I call a satellite descent. They form a small discourse that opposes those big Jewish problems. So if we are, for instance, talking about Jews being accused of banking or capitalism or Rothschild, we will be very surprised to find that they also run the opposition, i.e. Karl Marx, Marxism, Bolshevism, and so on and so on. Palestine has become a very, very big problem for the Jews. And far from being surprising, it didn't take long before bodies like JVP became the dominant force. JVP, for those who don't know, Jewish Voice for Peace, for instance, yeah, became a dominant force in the opposition to Israel. So it's quite an absurd, because the opposition to the oppressor is defined now by the sensitivities of the oppressor. Yeah. So when it comes to the Palestinian solidarity movement, we are more concerned with issues with anti-Semitism, than issues that trouble Palestinians. It is Jewish sensitivities that drive this discourse. Okay, I started to look into the dynamic between the Jewish main narrative and those various controlled oppositions or satellite dissent. And I realized that what we see really is a very vivid dynamic fight between these two bodies, the so-called problem and the descent to the problem. What is happening when this happens, and it's very important for me to mention, nothing of this dynamic is conspiratorial. I'm telling you something that you may never heard before. I argue that there are no Jewish conspiracies. In the Jewish world, everything is done in the open. The neocons were pushing for wars in the open. AIPAC is abusing your political system in the open. Capitalism, Rothschild, Goldman Sachs destroying countries, taking place in the open. George Soros funding the entire left identitarian nonsense in the open. In the Jewish world, there is a different tactic that is used. Rather than walking in a conspiratorial manner, they create a system that doesn't allow you to criticize what you see in front of your eyes. I define Jewish power as the power to suppress criticism of Jewish power. Okay? I continue. What is happening? Once this dynamic of conflict is established, let's, for instance, talk about the Palestinian solidarity movement that is now dominated by a few Jewish bodies. And on the other end, we see Israel, Zionism, and so on, and AIPAC. We start to see a huge fight. When this fight is taking place, something fundamental is happening. You good American people who are Jewish, remove yourself from the conflict, from the discourse. You remove yourself from engagement, direct engagement in Palestine, for instance, and you form a new theater on the parameter of the discourse. You say, we better stay out of this debate, because if we say something, they will start to call us anti-Semite, and we may lose our jobs, and we may, PayPal will close our account, and so on and so on. The outcome is pretty devastating, because every crucial topic, subject that is discussed within the American political, cultural, sociological, spiritual universe is now reduced into an internal political, internal Jewish debate. So, as we spoke, capitalism, banking, Wall Street, money, Goldman Sachs, what we have on the Jewish satellite dissent, we have the left, Karl Marx, Bernie Sanders, Trotsky, Rosa Luxemburg, and so on and so on. When it comes to Zionism, politics, AIPAC, Sheldon Adelson, we have dissent, Jewish lobby, J Street, George Soros, Occupy AIPAC, and all those kind of type of bodies that are basically Jewish descent. Palestine and Israeli brutality, we have Peace Now, we have B'Tselem in Israel, we have JVP, IJAN, IJAN is International Jewish Network, Anti-Zionist Network. Liberal values, cultural Marxism, Frankfurt School, political correctness, new left identity, and left, ladies and gentlemen, alt-right is pretty much a Jewish movement. We have Andrew Breitbart, Milo Yaninopoulos, David Horowitz, Breitbart.com, and Melanie Phillips here in Britain. You probably don't know her. I continue. Pro-war, neocons ideology, Zionist war, Sam Harris, obviously we have anti-war, Democracy Now, Amy Goodman, Noam Chomsky, you are completely out of these debates. In all those debates, we hardly see Americans. It turned into debates between two Jewish camps. Media domination, CNN, Wolf Blitzer, and so on and so on. We have the alternative media. Democracy Later, I think that in America you call it Democracy Now!, Paul Jay and The Real News, and so on and so on. When I give you an interesting example, I don't know if you remember, but there was in Texas, I think 3-4 years ago, there was this kind of a terror attack committed by so-called Islamists on a cartoon competition that was initiated by Pamela Geller. Do you remember that this happened? At a certain, can you recall this event?
Yes.
Anyone?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, what happened is that a lot of conservatives, Americans, said, why do we need this? Why this Pamela Geller is doing, is coming with those issues, with those kind of campaigns that actually incite hatred and push Muslims to act. It was amazing to watch that very quickly it was actually ultra Zionists such as Abe Foxman and the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center who were the first to target Pamela Geller and denounce her. So Pamela Geller became a problem, and it immediately it was Jewish right-wingers who took care of the controlled opposition. Because when they control opposition, nobody needs you anymore. And we can even go as far as Holocaust religion. You know, a lot of people are starting these days are upset by the Holocaust, which they see as a religion because it's something that doesn't allow us to revise, to look into, to suggest alternative visions. And even here, you can see that quite a few of the voices, and again, it's not conspiratorial at all, are Jewish. For instance, who is probably the guy who contributed the most to establish or legitimate the Holocaust revisionism? David Cole. But he's not alone. You have some Israelis like Yeshayahu Leibovich, a great Israeli philosopher. We have Paul Eisen, my dear friend. We have an Israeli academic, Hanna Yablonka, who is a kind of, to a certain extent, kind of offer a revisionist approach. Now, why do I mention all of it? Because one of the most troubling questions that 9/11 truthers are dealing with is the attempt to understand what is the role of Israel in the 9/11 event. Am I right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
I assume that I'm right. Or here is the news. What I try to give you today is a tool. How do you know that 9/11 is becoming a Jewish problem or an Israeli problem? The minute you start to see Jews for 9/11, the minute you start to see Jews interfering in the movement and offering different alternatives. Can you think of any Jews who have been doing just that? And operating as Jews? Okay. The reason that I mention it is because when I start to look into it, I found one. And his name is Elias Davidson. Are you familiar with his work?
Yep. Yes.
some of you should be familiar. I think that he's respected in the truth movement. You can find, I wrote an article called Kosherizing the 9/11 Movement, so you can find all the quotes. But I think that he is a good researcher, but he has a mission. He wants to defy the argument about Israel did 9/11, and this is a legitimate position. It is very interesting to see how he's doing it. I found an interview that was made by another AZZ, anti-Zionist, called Ludwig Wassel, who interviewed Davidson, and I found some incredible comments by Davidson. I found that Elias Davidson is very upset by Jew haters who keep referring to the, I'm quoting it, dancing Israelis, I'm quoting, the canal, the 4,000 Jews who forward did not go to work on the World Center on 9/11. He said with all those comments about 9/11, about Larry Silverstein, whom he tried to vindicate somehow. And the argument that he presents against the Israeli involvement is very interesting. I'm quoting now. Why it is not Silverstein? Why Silverstein is innocent? This is a quote. Because we have here all the requisite elements, a greedy Jew, a proximity to the crime, motive. It is precisely the high visibility of Larry Silverstein as an ideal villain that makes me, Davidson, can me, him, hesitate to implicate him in the crime. His alleged complicity is simply too obvious. So, according to Davidson, sorry?
Watch it. No.
So according to Davidson, it couldn't be Larry Silverstein because it's established the perfect crime. All right, it's vindicated because it's too close. All right, and I can read you more segments from his work. Now I'm not in a position to say whether he's right or he's wrong. I just want to give you the tools to identify how your discourse is deviated. Now, there may be other tactics, but this is exactly what I try to do. I'm specializing in Jewish identity politics, in the manners in which Jewish bodies, Jewish institutions, Jewish ideologies interfere within these different discourses. If you have any questions, I'm here to try to address them.
Well, okay, thank you. Thank you so much. You know what? We're going to now. First of all, I'm going to have to unmute everybody. I had to mute during the during your speech because of background noises. No, I don't think that. One. Oh, nobody's unmuting. Very odd. Well, we're just going to go into Q&A mode, so one moment, please, and we will. Are you Gilad Aspin, say yes or no, please.
Can I think most people are muted? Because I think
so I just unmuted. I just unmuted the first Bonnie Faulkner, and I'm asking if this is Gilad. Apparently not, so I'm going to mute. And then unmute the next one. Okay, is this Gilad? Gilad? No, apparently not. All right, we'll try the next one. Okay, Gilad, is this you? Gilad? No? Last but not least, Gilad, is this you?
Yeah, maybe.
There we go. Okay, so now we know who Gilad is.
Sorry, I hear you all the time, but okay.
Okay, so we're now ready for those in the queue. And before we get there, we need to talk just briefly about Q&A policy, because there have been many complaints recently about people overspending their time on Q&A and not leaving enough time for others. And you know that we're limited to about 10 total minutes here for Q&A, so that means you need to be pretty quick about making your comments. So essentially, you're going to get about a minute to make your comment or frame your question, after which, if you have a question, you need to state it clearly and concisely. And if you don't do that, Carol's going to whap you upside the head, okay? So let's start with Malcolm Arnold here, I think. He's first. No, he's not. Cat McGuire's first. Go ahead, Cat.
Okay, can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. A new documentary came out called The Lobby, and Gilad was saying how everything is done in the open. But one of the salient points about The Lobby is it's all hidden, shadowy surveillance of BDS groups in the USA, and it was all behind the scenes, and nothing is out in the open. And that was what was so sickening about it, was because the BDS movement people thought they were playing on a level playing field with the public opinion, and they're not. So how, Gilad, what do you have to say about a lot of the shadowy tactics? And if I may add, much of the surveillance worldwide software comes from Israel. So that's like DNA for them to be behind the scenes almost.
I'm pretty sure that some of the activity that the lobby is engaged in America, in Britain, in France, and so on and so on, is managed in a clandestine manner. But to be honest with you, I was quite bored. Watching the lobby, and we had a very similar program, Al Jazeera program, that was broadcast about the same operation in Britain, because all of that is known to us. You know, you don't need an Al Jazeera expose to know that when some truth seekers coming to your town, the Jewish lobby will do anything they can to dismantle these meetings, and when they don't succeed, JVP will continue where the AIPAC is failing. What you may miss is the particularity of the operation, but you know exactly who are the actors, and once they are once they succeed in canceling let's say a talk of Christopher Boylan, you will immediately see them bragging about it in the Jewish press. Am I right or wrong? I think that I'm right. And this is the operation. I insist to reveal to you all the parameters of the operation are known to us. They are known to us not because we are clever, because they insist to keep them open.
Okay.
I disagree.
Sorry, we're going to have to move on because. I'm sorry about that, Kat. I didn't know you had another comment. If you want to get back in the queue, I'll let you make your second comment real quick later. But Malcolm Arnold, you're up.
Yes, thank you, Gilad. I'm going to ask a question that's going to go a little bit further back. In your book, The Wandering Who, you trace Jewish history. And I'm kind of curious as to if you've ever formed an opinion or done any research or which researchers you would recommend regarding the Jewish history and its involvement with the occult, the ideologies that's driven the Ashkenazi Jews versus other Jews, going back to ancient mystery schools, maybe their involvement with Freemasonry and the Jesuits. I'm just kind of curious if you formed any opinions around any of these subjects and maybe what books that you could recommend if you have or research that you would recommend us reading.
Okay, so to start with, I'm not an historian. I am a philosopher, so for me it is very interesting to understand the metaphysics, or as you could see today, what I tried to elaborate on was the almost the algorithm that set this operation and the way it is managed. So rather than me offering you some anecdotal ideas, I went recently back to Douglas Reed, The Controversy of Zion. I hope that some of you heard about this book. And I, every time I look into this text, I'm shocked by its depth. It was written in 1952. And when you read it, you think that it was published yesterday. It is almost a prophetic. It presents the current Jewish identitarian project within the context of Jewish history of 2,500 years. And I would argue that this is the most important text. I believe that there are three main descent schools when it comes to Jewish study and the Jewish critical study. One is offered by Douglas Reed, which is very historicistic. Another one is offered by Kevin MacDonald, who looked into these issues from an evolutionary perspective. And the third one is offered by myself, which is looking into Jewish political symptoms from a cultural aspect or philosophical aspect. Now, it looks as if Douglas Reed, Kevin MacDonald, and myself share very little because we are pretty extreme in the way we dig into our topics. But I would suggest that the truth is somewhere in the middle. And I think that I hope that you don't think that it's too arrogant of me kind of locating myself together with Kevin and Douglas Reed, but I know that the reading that I produced was very different. It was kind of The Wandering Who was kind of an unusual book. I'm a jazz musician, so I, you know what is the definition of jazz musician? Jazz musician is a person who doesn't play the same thing once. It's a kind of a joke, but so I insist to be original in the way I deliver things and so on and so on. So I think that if you read Douglas Reed, if you read Kevin MacDonald, then if you read Gilad Atman, and you will have to find out how to synthesize all of it together. Now, there are quite a few other books that are very important if you are interested in history. And one of them is obviously Shlomo Zand, The Invention of the Jewish People. I think that this is his most important book. However, I'm not an historian. I'm more interested in the history of, in the philosophy of history. But the difference between Shlomo Zand and myself, Shlomo Zand is telling us that Jews invented themselves, and he has quite a solid argument. You can agree with it, you can reject it. What is way more interesting for me is the question which Shlomo Zand leaves unanswered. And this question is, okay, fine, they invent themselves. How do they get away with it? You are American, you cannot invent, all right? This is my question. And I think that I produce some unusual or original answer to this very question, which is,
I'm basically digging into
Jewish power.
Thank you. We'll have to leave it there because we're over time already. So we'll go to the next few of you, but please be very brief. We're out of time on this issue. Who's next here? Carl Golovin. Go ahead, Carl. Carl Golovin, you're up.
Can you hear me? Hello?
Yes.
I can hear
you. Carl Golovin, you are up. Please make your question. You said it briefly. Carl Golovin, are you there?
Sorry, now I think I'm off mute. Dot, thank you so much for recommending The Controversy of Zion by Douglas Reed. I just want to emphasize how important that book is. I would arguably say, apart from Scripture, it is the most important book I've ever discovered. And I've got probably 3,000 books. And just for background, Douglas Reed was an internationally renowned British journalist in the 1930s, 40s, up to the early 50s. And he'd even been present when the Reichstag fire happened, and wrote a book about that. But he wrote another book titled Far and Wide about the history of the U.S. in the context of Zionism and the European experience. And I've just ordered that. I haven't yet read it. But just to emphasize, The Controversy of Zion is like a Rosetta Stone.
Yeah. I agree. It's a text. You know, it's one of those books. It's a big book. It's a kind of, I don't know, what is it, 500 pages? It's very intense, and it's one of those books that you really want to read 2 pages a day. You know, when in my books, I try to make them kind of like bebop tunes. Kind of, there is a bit of a pyrotechnic, and you go through the entire text in 2 days. And Douglas Reed, you have to read it you read the Bible. And I'm a writer, and I'm quite a prolific writer, and I cannot understand how an ordinary human being manages to write such a text, sitting without computers. Yeah, this is in the 50s, writing such a text, such a deep text in such a short time. You know, I worked on it, I think, 4 or 5 years. It's incredible.
Well, just
it's incredible.
To very briefly interject, he did write this book after he was utterly shunned from his career in journalism, so he had free time to do the research. But he actually finished the controversy.
I know.
He finished it in 1956, but wasn't first published till 1978, 2 years after he died.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, I think we're going to have to leave this one there and give up the other two a chance to say what they need to say. So we'll go on to Barry Zwicker. Go ahead, Barry.
Oh, yes. It's about Elias Davidson. And we're good friends. I immensely respect him, stayed in his home. But we have had quite a bit of back and forth on this question about Jewish involvement, shall we say, in 9/11. And we partly agreed to disagree and partly we agreed. But I wonder if you have any further insight into why Elias would have taken the stance he has exemplified in the quote about Silverstein that you gave us.
Yeah, I think that Elias Davidson is a Jewish ethnic activist. Elias Davidson was desperate to ruin the reputation of the Wandering Jew as it came out. And by the way, I will try to send you guys kosherizing the 9/11 truth movement. Maybe I'll send it to Nita or so you can all. I send it to Sherry. Okay.
So that's fine.
Yeah. So that's what. Yeah, I'm just doing it now, so I didn't remember. It's done. It's sent. And so you can all read it. I didn't mean to attack Elias Davidson because he's not with us. But I provide you now the paper, and as you yourself, I forgot your name. Sorry. You mentioned that you debated this issue with him. I gave earlier today a talk in Liverpool to Palestinian supporters, and they asked me the same question about another guy, maybe some of you know him, Tony Greenstein, a notorious AZZ activist, what we call here anti-Zionist. And they ask, is it genuine for Palestine? I cannot say. Maybe it is. It's very possible that Elias Davidson is genuine. It's very possible that Tony Greenstein is genuine. It is very possible that Silverstein of Tikkun Olam is genuine. But I think that their primary concern is the tribe. The tribe come first. Otherwise, I cannot understand why there is a reason to vindicate Israel, for instance, and not to look into it. The decision where Israel is guilty or not is something that we do after we learn the case, not before the case is examined. All right? This is how we operate. This is how detectives work. They look into an event and then they come with some conclusions. When it comes to Jewish history, to Jewish involvement, Jewish lobby involvement in different events, we always decide where the discourse, as far as how far the discourse can go, and then the outcome is that we basically not allowed. Or not allowing ourselves to understand what really happened.
Okay.
Very good.
Very good answer. Yep, thanks. And last is Barbara Honegger. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, G. Lod. Barbara Honegger. Hi.
Yeah, how are you?
Yeah, so it's great seeing you in both New York City and Oakland, California. And I'm looking forward to that next book of yours called The Last Sabra. Remember? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm holding you to that title now. Remember, we made a pact.
Yeah, it's a great title.
Okay.
Yeah.
I have a very simple question, but it's a very big question. And I don't expect you to probably be able to answer it here, but maybe we can have a dialogue offline.
Okay.
And that is this. This is my opinion. It's a very informed opinion about 9/11.
Yeah.
I believe that there was significant Jewish and especially American Zionist involvement in the planning operation and cover-up. There's no question in my mind about this. All right. So my question is this. How do we bring the real perpetrators to justice publicly without triggering a backlash against innocent Jews as happened in Nazi Germany? That is my question, because until we can satisfy ourselves with that answer and have a plan for protecting those innocent Jews, it's very problematic to tell the whole truth to the court system, to the public, whatever. But we need to do it. So we have to solve this Gordian knot. So that's my question.
I think that this question accept an element of prejudice and Jewish privilege that should be very alarming to many people, including you guys. If you have the evidence that some Jews were involved, take them to the cleaners. I think that you should concentrate on the truth, and the truth only, and without prejudice. All right? Would you ask yourself the same question if you were convinced that the perpetrators were Muslims? I can tell you that according to the official narrative, they were Muslims, not that anyone that I know believed the official narrative, and nobody in America said, oh, you cannot say these kind of things about Muslims. If you think that it is Jews, you should uphold exactly the same attitude. Concentrate on the facts, not on the consequences. It's not your job to save the tribe. Your job is to save the truth, to save your nation, to make your nation a strong nation, to make America great again for real. This is my answer.
Thank you very much, Gilad.
My pleasure.
Gilad, thank you so much for sharing time with us tonight and for bringing us up to speed on your latest work. We look forward to having you back whenever you can find the time. I hope you enjoyed it as well.
Yeah, I did, actually.
Good deal. All right.
Can we invite you, Lod, to stay on for the next segment?
You're certainly welcome to stay on.
It's 2 o'clock in the morning and I'm starting at 6, so I have to catch a few hours here.
Right.
All right. Be sure and listen to the audio of this section, Gilad. Mm-hmm. We've had a major legal breakthrough on 9/11 justice, so be sure and listen to it when you get the audio.
Okay. So you will send it to me.
We'll send you the link. Yep.
All right.
For sure,
Gilad.
Thanks
so much.
Thank you, Gilad.
Okay, that brings us to our second big event tonight, and that will be the Lawyers Committee and the Great Breakthrough in the Courts System. So here to introduce our special guests for that regard is Barbara Honegger. Go ahead, Barbara.
Okay. Can you hear me, Sue? All right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. All right. So tonight I have the honor of introducing my friends, my dear friends and colleagues in the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. We're all on the board. The first is David R. Meiswinkle, who is a criminal defense attorney. I should say he is the president of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. He is a criminal defense attorney, retired police officer of 23 years. And, I lost my page. And a former U.S. Army officer. His activism in municipal corruption has brought federal authorities in New Brunswick, New Jersey, which led to a major criminal investigation, arrests, indictments, and convictions of prominent local politicians. 2 years ago, he and his Quantum Matrix radio co-host and friend Pamela Sensi trekked 440 miles, 47 days to honor those who died from 9/11, their families, and to restore our Constitution. And I believe, he can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that he ran for the governor of New Jersey against Chris Christie. Unfortunately, he did not win. So that's Dave Meiswinkle. And also to tell you about the breakthrough with the U.S. Attorney in the Southern District of New York on November 7th of this year is our Director of Litigation, Nick Harrison, who is an attorney. He is Executive Director, as I said. He is a public interest lawyer in private practice with 25 years of experience litigating whistleblower protection lawsuits and environmental protection citizen lawsuits nationwide. In those 25 years, he's represented and assisted citizens groups and whistleblowers in their efforts to expose violations of law and misconduct by government and corporate officials. And I would like to add that he has a great record of success in doing so. He has litigated FOIA cases, False Claim Act cases, cases involving workers' rights. He has recently had a very successful outcome in a 9/11 case with the EPA, with a whistleblower at the EPA. He might want to tell you about that briefly. His former clients include the Sierra Club, Greenpeace, Vietnam Veterans Organization, Chemical Weapons Working Group, and all kinds of national nonprofit organizations. I could go on and on, but I know we're short for time, so I would just like to invite, probably Mick will begin because he's our Director of Litigation. So we'll hear from Mick Harrison and David Meiswinkel. So take it off.
Okay, I need to...
I think you need to unmute Mick and Dave.
Well, the funny thing is the responses aren't happening, so I was trying to go into lecture mode here. I guess I have to end Q&A mode first.
Yeah, probably.
Oh, not responding. Cheryl, can you try it?
Let me see. Yeah, I couldn't get it to work either for myself earlier. Nick
hey,
is Mick
yeah,
is okay.
Okay, if Mick, how about David? David, do you have the microphone? David, Meiswinkel, are you able to speak?
I'm trying to unmute him, but it's not working.
Oh, dear.
Can you unmute everybody, Ken?
I tried. David, can you speak now?
Dave Meiswinkel, if you press *6, if you haven't already, you can unmute yourself. Maybe we can hear from Mick and try it again.
Okay.
Okay.
All right, are you ready?
Yes, go ahead. Go ahead, Nick. We can hear you
anyway. All right, thanks. So good evening, folks. We have had a breakthrough with the Lawyers Committee's work. The gist is that, as you may recall from our previous talks, April, we filed our petition with the U.S. Attorney in New York presenting evidence of the demolition of 3 World Trade Center buildings on 9/11. In July, we filed with an amended petition, which added several additional federal crimes, same evidence on the demolition. And about 4 months later, which was 2 or 3 weeks ago, as Barb says, on November 7th, a letter was issued. We didn't actually get it in our hands for a couple weeks because of logistics, but a letter was issued by the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York, and it's a very short letter to the point, but what the U.S. Attorney says is that they will comply with the federal law that governs special grand juries, which requires when a citizen, such as the Lawyers Committee, reports evidence of a federal crime, that crime be in turn reported by the U.S. Attorney to a special grand jury, and that the special grand jury be told who it was that reported the crime. So the U.S. Attorney hasn't spelled out yet details to us of what steps they will take specifically, but they have agreed to comply with that law, which was the purpose of our petition, to get them to comply and to report the demolition crimes on 9/11 to a special grand jury. So as of this moment, from all indications, the demolition crimes that we have been concerned about on 9/11 will now be at least reported to a special grand jury, and that grand jury will be told that it was the Lawyers Committee who reported those crimes. There are questions we don't know yet, don't know the answers to yet, We don't know if all of our evidentiary exhibits will be given to the special grand jury. We don't know what the U.S. attorney will say to the special grand jury in terms of the U.S. attorney's own opinion on this evidence. Those are questions that we hope to get answered. We don't know those answers yet. I did want to clarify that this decision by the U.S. attorney to comply with our petition request to report this to the special grand jury was not done in response to a mandamus lawsuit, even though we anticipated that such a mandamus lawsuit might be necessary. It turns out that that lawsuit is not yet necessary because we appear to have compliance, at least compliance in progress. So the response from the U.S. attorney was actually simply a direct response to our petitions. So I did want to make one other clarification, and that is there was some reference in your agenda to the identification of specific persons of interest. And to clarify, our petition did not name any suspects. It did describe some categories of persons who may have material information relevant to the grand jury's inquiry, and we're actually working on a detailed, investigative report regarding persons who may have material information, and we have not yet decided when that will be completed, although it may well be done fairly soon. And depending on how things go with the U.S. attorney's inquiry, we may be presenting it to the U.S. attorney soon. There is a chance, and we don't know yet how big of a chance, that the Lawyers Committee may itself be presenting evidence directly to the special grand jury. We have asked the U.S. attorney for that opportunity, and that's one of the questions we have not got an answer to yet. So I think I'll stop there. And then if Dave Meiswinkel can be unmuted.
He's unmuted.
Can you hear me?
Yes,
am I there?
You, David.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I was having problems. I was trying to get on and hitting star 6 and it wasn't doing it, so I had to cut myself off and call back in.
Yeah.
Thank you, and thanks for inviting us on. I can see that the people we're addressing are very astute politically and historically, so that this is really historically a significant event, providing that they, in good faith, do the legislative responsibilities that the law tells them to present the evidence that was given to them to a special grand jury. Now, this is evidence that you can review it on the website. It's lc4911.org. And all the attachments are there, the exhibits. And it's a smorgasbord, so to speak, in a good way, of a lot of the work that architects and engineers has done over the years and other researchers. So we tried to put all the important things in there. There's videos in there, and there's forensic evidence and expert opinions and eyewitness testimony, et cetera. And there are some anomalies, too, like Jane Stanley's comments, et cetera. She worked for the BBC when she announced Building 7 was down before it collapsed. So I like to think this is a litmus test as far as the viability of our system, whether the powers that be can address the most egregious crime of our lifetime and get some kind of closure for all the victims and their family members, and start to really do an investigation. It's a pity that it's taken 17 years to get to the point we are today, which with real law enforcement and a real judiciary would have accomplished this right at the beginning. So we all know that, and you guys could probably educate us on a lot of the flaws of the investigation that was not done, but we're optimistic, and we're going to stay abreast of it as best we can. As Mick says, that, the ball's now in their court. So technically, in a way that we've taken the action or the energy to them, they have to respond to us now. And we're waiting to hear what they have to say into a letter that we've written to them. And And hopefully, you know, it goes forward and they do what they're supposed to do. So the lawyers committee now is that's what we're doing right now with the grand jury petition. But we have other actions we want to do. Remember, this is only New York City. There was incidents in Washington and Shanksville that have never been investigated. And the reason we picked New York is because, obviously, it's the, well, besides the most sensational, it's where the evidence was accumulated and gathered by the architects and engineers for the most part. So the other parts are, the other crime scenes, and these are crime scenes, are going to be a little more difficult, probably, to gather evidence. So, saying that, if you want to help us and you know some leads we should follow, well, they should contact us. And as we proceed beyond New York, hopefully we can do that, into these other areas, maybe you can, well, your input might be invaluable. So we have other actions like the Freedom of Information actions, where we make requests to the government, and it's for transparency, but to get documents that the public should have that they don't have. And this will allow us to assess the truth of the stories and also be able to ask for more documents and sort of like burrow in. And so that's some other things that we're doing in addition to some state actions, all right, to right to know actions and open public records actions. So, again, it's too early to say a whole lot about the grand jury petition as it the wording, I don't know if Mick read it to you, but the wording was we have received the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 inquiry submissions of April 10th and July 30th. We will comply with the provisions of 18 U.S.C. 3332 as they relate to your submissions. And basically what that says is that they have an obligation when reasonable evidence is brought to their attention to present that to a special grand jury. Now, the crimes that were are documented in the amended complaint or the amended petition of July 30th were federal law criminalizing bombings in places of public use and government facilities. That was in the first petition, but then we added three more counts to make it stronger. Federal law criminalizes acts of terrorism transcending national boundaries. Federal law criminalizes providing support to terrorists, and federal law criminalizes the killing of a federal government agent and employee. And it should be stressed, too, that what we're asserting is that these were pre-planted explosives, controlled demolitions, and or incendiary devices were detonated and ignited at the World Trade Center complex on 9/11. And what we're saying is that this is dispositive. This is like a no-brainer. When you look at this evidence, you'll come away with saying that certainly there's probable cause for indictments here, and then that's the question, who you're going to indict, right? But certainly the official story will be undermined, and that's the first thing we have to do. And as probably all of you know, the official story was fires brought down the buildings, impossible, never happened before, never happened again, and we know why, all right? We know the science behind, thanks to architects and engineers. So that's about as much as I can say right now. Mick, you can follow me up and say some more, and we'd be open to questions.
Well, I think that's fine, David. I'm open to questions if folks want to ask.
Okay. Well, it looks like everybody's kind of muted here. I'm going to try this once.
May I make a comment, Barb?
Well, I guess everybody's not muted. Everybody seems to be muted, but maybe they're not. So
I found, Ken, if you stay on the name long as you click it, it'll unmute it one person at a time. So do you want everyone unmuted right now?
Well, what I wanted to do was go into Q&A mode, but I didn't want to do that if people were already muted and couldn't unmute. But let's try it. Let's see what happens.
What are we trying?
I'm trying Q&A mode, but see, it's not responding. Maybe it thinks we're still in Q&A mode. I don't really know.
Can it respond?
Press the star 6 and see if we should, see if you show up on the queue. And someone other than Cheryl and myself, just press star 6. If anybody gets a response that they're being muted by doing that, let me know that too. Because
well, I think what it's doing is it's putting them in the Q&A right now.
No, it's not. I don't see them. Do you?
Under Q&A, yeah, I see four people there, five.
Well, okay, so my screen, okay, I've lost internet.
Do you want me to unmute everybody?
Yeah. No, just do Q&A and unmute Mick and David, okay?
Yeah, they're still unmuted, okay.
Okay, we're good together. So you just call the shots here, okay? Just click next, and then let that person ask the question.
Okay, so Mike Cook, you're next for the first question.
Hey, this is Mike Cook. I don't think I've ever been happier in my life when I heard about this, and I just want to thank everybody so much for working on this. A couple quick questions, trying to take up much time. Is this going to be a real trial, like where people will appear in person, or is DOJ just going to hand over what you've handed to them to these folks, and we'll never see them or know who they are or whatever, and whatever answer they come back with? Also, it's really good that you pursue all avenues, you know, Shanksville and the Pentagon. Kudos to you. And I'll be in touch. Thank you.
All right. So to answer your question, we don't know yet whether we'll be allowed to present testimony directly to the grand jury, which would be more of the trial-like format. So that may happen still. Grand jury proceedings, you may or may not realize, are normally secret, unlike an open trial. The open trial happens later if there's an indictment. And
yes,
criminal
I'm aware.
Prosecution. Okay, that is open. So, you know, if we are invited to testify, we still won't see any other testimony given by anyone else that the grand jury calls in, and we won't know until the end of the process the outcome. At some point, that outcome, you know, will be made public.
Pretty shady stuff. Thank you.
Well,
so, if the grand jury, if you're not allowed to pursue this with the grand jury, then is the grand jury told that you had made the request and it was denied or not?
The grand jury is told.
Okay.
We made the request and is told the crimes that were reported.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's up to the grand jury under law what happens next. They can call witnesses in. They can subpoena people. They can offer immunity. They mm-hmm. can do a number of things. Now, in modern practice, the U.S. attorneys tend to be, influential in what the grand jury does, maybe more than they should be. So
but who makes the decision about whether you're permitted to present?
Well, that should be the grand jury.
The grand jury itself, okay. And then the other question I had real quick was, what's a reasonable time frame that you would consider for this coming before the grand jury?
We haven't been told a time frame. Grand juries are impaneled for 18 months maximum, I believe, special grand juries.
Mm-hmm.
We have some decisions to make internally about how long we're willing to wait
mm-hmm.
if we don't hear anything before we move to what I would call the backup plan, and we do have a backup
mm-hmm.
plan. And one of those backup plans is to do a mandamus action.
Sure.
To a federal court to make sure.
What's the norm? What's the norm in these kinds of cases?
It varies with the crime and the case.
There's never been a case.
I think you're talking. Go ahead. Sorry, I cut somebody off.
I'm sorry. Never been a case like this before. So.
Yeah, hard to know.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead. Click the next one, please, Cheryl.
Okay. Yep. Charles Ewing Smith.
Oh, hi, Mick. This is Chuck Smith.
Hey, thank you,
Mick, and thanks, Dave. Hey, listen, I'm looking for the weak link in this wonderful event, and it occurs to me that we don't have any way of knowing who and how the members of the grand jury are selected, and that seems like a weak link. What do you guys think?
Go
ahead, Dave.
Well, you're right, but you can think that any time a jury is selected, supposedly they're supposed to be selected in an objective way, usually from the voter list. So technically anyone out there probably could be a grand juror. And it's supposed to be 16 to 23 people, my understanding, on the grand jury. And they, of course, they need 12 of 16 being present to make an indictment. That's my understanding. But it's a good question, but I think that's, you know, I think that it's something you just have to believe that the grand jury is going to be objective based on juries and how they're picked. I don't know.
But Meg, normally when they're picked, aren't witnesses allowed to watch the jury selection?
That's true. In a non-grand jury case, so you got two different steps here, Chuck. You got the selection from the general pool of registered voters, the folks who will serve on one of either the grand juries or the petite juries, which are the normal juries, and then you've got the second phase, which is who serves on which particular jury. And it's the latter phase where you have what you're contemplating, what you see on television sometimes, what we call the voir dire, voir dire, where the jurors are questioned and some are excused and some are accepted. That's a little different for the grand jury process because you don't have opposing parties. At least you don't always have opposing parties present. The defendants may not be known yet, and that is the case here. So the government can probably strike some of those potential grand jurors for cause, if they have cause, legally recognized cause, like bias. But I don't know that process is public. We can make a little inquiry and get back to you on that. It's possible that once they're selected, those names actually might be discoverable of who the grand jurors are.
And what the selection process was, or what the question
I think there's a record of the selection process. I think there is.
Okay, great.
Well, I hope so. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Okay, on to the next. Sherry Aston.
Hi, this is Sherry here in San Diego. And my question kind of was what Charles's was. What was the process of the jury selection? And do they ask questions like they do in a normal jury that, like, are you familiar with 9/11? Do you have an opinion on 9/11? Do they ask those types of questions before they pick the juror? And if we go through all this process and the grand jury says, yes, there's overwhelming evidence that explosives were used, then what's the next step? That's my question. Thank you.
So I believe the government can ask those types of questions to qualify or disqualify a grand juror. The court can do that as well. I doubt they will be invited to do that, although that would certainly be acceptable to us, but I don't expect to be invited to do that. And without a known defendant, you know, I don't think you're going to have a defendant's lawyer there doing that. In terms of what happens after the grand jury decides, yes, there's sufficient evidence to find that a crime was committed, the normal next step is for them to inquire into who committed the crime and see if there is sufficient evidence to indict a specific person or persons. We're working, as I mentioned, on that angle. That evidence is not currently before the U.S. attorney, and therefore it's not, to our knowledge, before a special grand jury. At least we didn't present it. So I think that's an important second phase. We're sort of gearing up, assuming the best and preparing for the worst. Assuming the best means that we're going to get a chance to present evidence ourselves, and that includes evidence on who may have committed the crime. So we're currently trying to garner resources and also, you know, dedicate time and talent to the task of being ready if we are called upon to make the best case. So if that doesn't happen, our next best option is to give a detailed written report as a supplement to the petition we already filed on the whodunit part, and that is in progress.
Great. Okay, let's go on to the next question then. Let's see, Barbara Honegger?
Yeah, hi, I have a comment, actually. I just want people to give the big picture. The good news is we got a yes from the U.S. attorney. The law requires him to present our petition and the 57 evidentiary exhibits to a special criminal grand jury. That's very, very big. That's the good news. The bad news is it's secret. So we hope they will invite us to present
to the grand jury. That is by no means a guarantee, but we're going to do everything we can diplomatically to try to cooperate and work with them. They don't have to say yes. I just want people to have realistic expectations. But believe me, we have layers of backup plans. So just be confident of that. I just have an announcement, and that is that David Meiswinkle and Mick Harrison and Richard Gage and myself, as their host, as it were, along with the radio show host Richard Hoagland, will be on the Other Side of Midnight radio show this Saturday night, beginning at 9 p.m. West Coast time, midnight East Coast time for an hour. And to watch live or to listen live, I'll send this to everybody on the 9/11 list, but to listen live, you go to theothersideofmidnight.com, and you're going to click on the, scroll down just a little bit on that homepage, click on a picture of exploding towers. It'll be something, some image of the Twin Towers with the headline, which will be something like 9/11 Truth and Justice Breakthrough. Click on that image and wait a second, and the same image will come up. You'll think you're on the same page. You aren't. Scroll down just a hair and click on the play button right at 9 o'clock Western, midnight Eastern, or maybe a minute after to listen live to the program. It goes to about 115 countries. So we invite you to join us. And there are Q's and A's at the end.
All right. Thank you, Barbara.
Okay. And just to add to that, if I could add to that, the questions are good questions, and it's questions we think about, too. The thing is that we've not been down this road before in this way. And the nature of the crime is so outrageous and so significant that, anything can happen here. I think, in part, it's almost like being in a fight or a competition. Your instincts would take over to some extent, and as far as how you press the U.S. attorney, the questions you ask them, and to try to make sure there's compliance and they're acting in good faith. So exactly how we do that, but we know we have to do that probably. We want to make sure that this is being done, that the evidence is being presented. And so, as I said, the questions are good questions. We know that that they have to be answered, hopefully in the affirmative, and we're going to do everything we can to make sure they are.
Okay, thank you. And on to the last question for these guys, Carl Golovin.
Hi, Carl Golovin. Just a quick question. What is it, the name of the prosecutor that responded to you?
We don't know. Well, actually, we do know a couple of the names that signed the letter for Attorney Berman. The U.S. attorney is Jeffrey Berman, but it's not likely he would handle personally the work with the grand jury. So
right.
we do know the two names of the folks who responded for the U.S. attorney, and I'll tell you those names. Just one second. Here we go. So it is Michael Ferrara and Elon Groff, and they are chiefs, Terrorism and International Narcotics Unit in the U.S. Attorney's Office, Southern District of New York.
Oh, thank you. I was just considering sending them a letter, just a brief side note. I was a responder as a special agent, U.S. Customs Office of Internal Affairs. There were teams of us over a period of months that were tasked with sifting specifically the rubble of World Trade Center 7 after it was brought to Freshkill's landfill, working sifting machinery there. And our briefing was that CIA and Secret Service, among others, or occupants of the building, did not want any electronic components left in the rubble, which at the time, not knowing the collapse dynamics, made reasonable sense. In retrospect, if it was a botched controlled demolition, we would have helped sift evidence of that, demolition electronics out of the rubble. And all the various agencies would have correspondence between each other requesting the assistance of, we were told it was the FBI and ourselves were the ones that worked the rubble of number seven. So just FYI.
Well, that's very interesting. You may want to send us your contact information. I mean, if you would be willing to tell your story to the grand jury, if we ever get invited, we'll put you on our list.
Sure, I've got the work schedules with the names of those of us who are on our 3-week rotation. They're all up there in groups of maybe 20 or so for 3 weeks at a time.
Okay. Well,
okay.
Keep in touch.
Yeah, we'll do. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, we have one more person who's just asked to do a question. It's P.F. Soto. Go ahead, P.F.
Yes, this is P.F. Soto. I just wanted to ask Barbara and Ken to make sure I'm on their list because I didn't have a chance to write down so much of what I wanted to from this, but especially about the discussion that's going to happen this Saturday. I would like to get that out far and wide. And I echo what Michael said. Nothing has made me happier than what's going on here. So thank you.
Well, I'll double check and make sure you're subscribed to our listserv, PF. If you're not, I'll make sure you're subscribed. Okay.
Thank you.
But do send me your email address just in case I don't come in ahead.
All right. Will do.
All right. So that brings us to the end of this one. And thank you so much, both Nick, David, Barbara, for this presentation, for bringing us up to speed on a monumental breakthrough in 9/11 truth and justice. We can only hope for the best and ask you to keep us surprised as things develop, okay?
Yep. Thank you for your support. Yep, thanks.
Okay, and of course, that you'll keep us informed about anything that we as activists may be able to do in support of your effort. That's the key. So, having said that, let's move on to our final agenda item tonight, and that will be the new breakthroughs in the JFK assassination research. That will be given to us by Barbara Honegger, and though no one on this call probably needs an introduction to Barbara, since we have new listeners listening to the recording all the time, and just for the sake of form, Cheryl's going to give us a brief introduction. Go ahead, Cheryl.
Okay. So Barbara is a leading researcher, author, and public speaker on September 11, 2001. She's a board member and grand jury petition drafting committee member of the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry. She has served as White House policy analyst and Department of Justice official in the Reagan administration, and for over a decade was the senior military affairs journalist at the Naval Postgraduate School of the Department of Defense. Due to her access to high-level military and civilian officials, she was able to piece together the inside story of the Pentagon attack on 9/11, resulting in her authoritative work behind the smoke curtain. She's also the author of the whistleblower account of October Surprise, the book October Surprise, which led to a full subpoena-powered House of Representatives investigation. And Barbara, we can't wait to hear what the latest news is on the JFK assassination, so please, it's your turn. Go ahead. Is Barbara unmuted?
Since there are no active speakers.
Okay, Barbara, are you there?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yep.
Oh, good. You can hear me now. I was off the phone for a moment. I had to call back in. Thank you. All right. So I'm just going to give you the highlights, everybody, of the two JFK conferences that were unfortunately simultaneous, about 4 miles apart, in Dallas, the Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I think it was 16th, 17th, and 18th of November. I attended those with the former president of the Lawyers Committee, still a member of the Lawyers Committee, Jane Clark, and Bonnie Faulkner, well known for having the nationwide Pacifica Network radio show Guns and Butter. So Jane and a friend of hers went to what's called the Lancer Conference, JFK Conference. Lancer was JFK's Secret Service code name, as I understand it. And I did not go to that conference except for one critical presentation, which is what I'm going to focus on here. Bonnie and I both spoke at the other conference. The other conference is called the Dallas JFK Conference, and the organizer and MC, the hostess of that, is Lee Harvey Oswald's mistress, Judith Mary Baker, who is quite a character. In any case, the two conferences are very different.
The conference that Bonnie and I went to is basically the witnesses, the eyewitnesses, people who are close, who knew the eyewitnesses, people who knew JFK, JFK bodyguards, the honor guard who carried the fancy casket to Bethesda Hospital, Naval Hospital, those kinds of people who are eyewitnesses. Those are the ones that Bonnie and I wanted to hear. We also, by the way, all three of us went last year to this these conferences. The other conference, you are able to see in advance who the speakers are, and my curiosity and excitement was triggered by seeing the blurb and the subject lines, the title of the talk of the first conference. The first conference I mentioned, the Lancer conference. So I went to that only the second day, only the third day. The morning of the, it was basically the last presentation of that conference. And the Lancer conference, this was the last year it will ever be held. So it was basically the last presentation of the last Lancer conference that's been going on now for years. And it was a mind blower. The speaker is a former Air Force major, specialist intelligence analyst for the Air Force. His name is Major Ralph Gannis, G-A-N-I-S. And his presentation is based upon his new book. I highly recommend everyone in the world buying it. It's called The Skorzeny Papers. That's called that's spelled S-K-O-R-Z-E-N-Y. Who is Otto Skorzeny? Otto Skorzeny was Adolf Hitler's top assassin and commando, special operations trainer and operator throughout World War II. And at the end of World War II, shortly after the end of World War II, 1948, he was taken, put in a POW camp prison, and he was basically sprung out of that prison by the Allies secretly and came over to the Allied side about 2 years after the war was over, a little bit more, and started working for the Allies and Israel, the new state of Israel. So you have this incredible situation where Hitler's top assassin and commando started training the very first Mossad officers in the new state of Israel, as well as about 1,000 special operations assassin commandos for all of the Allied powers during World War II, the United States, France, Britain, and the new state of Israel, so and a few others. So the exciting thing about what Major Gannis presented is that by an incredible series of historic synchronicities, he learned about synchronistically and was the winning bidder on what were believed not to exist, that is, Skorzeny's private papers. And the bottom line is after over 3 years of reviewing over 1,000 pages of these documents that Skorzeny, just before he died, he put in the hands of his wife, Ilse, who was also a top Nazi agent. And then those papers, just before she died, they were given to a family that they knew, and that passed down through those generations, I believe, to the grandson, who didn't have any idea what they were, but knew they were valuable. I had never opened the box, never read them, and they put them on the open auction here in the United States. And Major Gannis, who I consider to be an international hero for what he has done, he was the successful bidder, and he had to hock a lot of his valuable possessions to buy the papers, which cost him over $20,000, which he really didn't have. But he bought them, and he has dedicated the last 3 to 4 years of his life to the content of this book. He did FOIAs to the National Archives. He got every single declassified document on Otto Skorzeny and his network after World War II, during and after World War II. And he's integrated all of that. He's cross-correlated it all. And now I'm going to give you the bottom line. The bottom line is that Hitler's top assassin and commando throughout World War II, after being brought over to the Allies, beginning in 1948, was the lead trainer in Spain for a commando training center for the most top secret assassin networks for the Allies, not just the United States government, but the others as well. And it is his network that Major Gannis has proven through the papers themselves, the main shooter at the critical headshot at Dealey Plaza was by one of the assassins in Scorzani's network. That's the bottom line. So Ralph Gannis and Daniel Sheehan and myself were on The Other Side of Midnight, the same show that Mick and Dave and Richard Gage and I will be on this Saturday night at 9 o'clock West Coast time, midnight East Coast time, on theothersideofmidnight.com. Same show, it's 3 hours total, from midnight to 3 a.m. Eastern, every Saturday and Sunday night. Last Sunday night, Major Gannis, at my invitation, and the host Richard Hoagland's excitement and agreement, approval, Major Gannis and Daniel Sheehan, who's the world-famous attorney. Many people don't know that Danny Sheehan is a professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz, and he, to his knowledge, has the only full university course, the entire quarter, on the JFK assassination, all of the different theories and the evidence for them of who were the planners, perpetrators, and cover-up artists of the JFK assassination. So he's an expert as well. So it's myself, Danny Sheehan, and Major Gannis. And I highly recommend you listen to that program. It will blow your mind, and I'm going to send the link to it. It's an audio link that you can listen to anytime. But what I highly recommend, I'm going to send Cheryl and Ken and Craig two links. I'm going to send them a link where you can listen on the website, the Other Side of Midnight website, through this Friday at midnight for free. And then I'm also going to give you a link after that in perpetuity. But right now that link is not live. So you have until Friday to hear it on the website. I will let you know in a little text block that goes with the link how to listen to it through Friday. And I'll also give a link that hopefully will be live in perpetuity after that. So that's the bottom line. If anybody has any questions, there were many other speakers, of course. There were 3 days at two conferences each for a total of 6 days and nights. We started at 8:30 or 9 a.m. There were talks during lunch. There were talks during dinner, and it went to about 10 o'clock every night. So you can imagine how many presentations there were. If you are interested, I'd be happy to send the speakers list, the programs for both conferences, be sent out, or I can send them out myself. That would be easier, actually, to the 9/11 list, so that if you have any questions, you can ask me about them. So if anybody has any questions, go ahead. So star 6 if anyone wants to be in the Q&A. Hello?
Yep, just a second, Barbara. All right, so we have a couple people who have questions. I'm going to start with Malcolm. Are you on mute?
Yes, I'm here. Thank you, Barbara. We have a name on to attach to the shooter from who did the headshot. Do we know exactly who it was, or do we just know that it was a person of a team?
No, I know the name. I can put it in my email. He's the French shooter. It's named something like Sucre.
Thank you.
Yeah. Now, by the way, that shooter was known before. What hasn't been known before is that he was trained in part of Scorzani's assassin network, formerly Hitler's commando.
Okay, and next is from Carl Golovin. Carl?
Yes, Barbara. I'm surprised you. The name. I'm sure I can recall if I dig deep enough in my memory. There's really no need to be secretive about it or to require an email to disclose it. But also, Judith Berry Baker and her group, which organized the conference, I think they would very much prefer to be the ones who distribute recordings and such of the various events at their conference directly. Also,
just hold on. I don't think you heard me correctly. This is
right,
not
this,
a program that has any. This is a separate radio interview. It has nothing to do with either conference.
Oh, I thought it came out of the Lancer conference.
No. No, this is a separate radio interview last Sunday night, a few days ago, with Major Gannis. He had never done a radio interview in his life before this Sunday, and I invited him to do it, made the arrangements, and got Danny Sheehan on as well.
Very good. Well done. Also, just for the record, I believe Danny Sheehan, who is a very visible figure, and I admire much of what he's done. I understand he is the attorney for the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits in America.
No, that's not correct. He was for about 10 years in the past, not anymore.
Okay. I just thought that was an interesting footnote.
Well, I want everybody to know that I'm a 40-year friend, as well as colleague of Danny Sheehan, and he is one of the most outstanding human beings I've ever met.
Okay, so next, it says it's Bonnie Faulkner, but I'm not sure who this is, so could you say who you are first before you ask your question? You're on the Q&A. Is it Michael Springman? If anyone on here who's gone on the Q&A, please try and say something.
Hello, this is Nita.
Oh, Nita, hi, Nita. Okay, yeah, you're coming up as Bonnie Faulkner. We know you're not, but okay.
Well, maybe Bonnie Faulkner is Nita. You never know.
You never know.
We're in two places. Yeah. Well, one, I was going to ask the name of the person, but two, more interesting, the man who did the headshot, was he in any way directly or indirectly connected to the Israeli forces that Skorzeny was training?
Well, according to
just by association,
I highly recommend that everyone listen to the Other Side of Midnight radio show from this last Sunday, and that is addressed, but I'll give you the gist of the answer. Based upon the Skorzeny papers, and they are extremely detailed, name after name after name, corporation after corporation, he's got the whole flow chart in there. These are basically the papers that Skorzeny had hidden away and let people know he had as his insurance, as his life insurance policy. Okay, so it really names names, and Major Gannis is absolutely adamant. Now, whether he's correct or not, I can't tell you. I believe he is. But he is adamant that when you read the book and you read the papers, and by the way, he says anybody who comes to, I think he's in North Carolina, he'd be happy to show him the papers. There are over 1,000 pages. He says he is adamant that Skorzeny was not doing this for Israel. Israel was a beneficiary. Israel was one of the allies who was told about it and officially but secretly signed off on it. But did they do it? No. This was a CIA national security operation by the United States government. That's what he said.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the end of our questions. Ken, are you there?
Calling for Ken.
Ken is muted, just a minute.
Oh, wow.
Okay, now you're unmuted, Ken. Oh, now you're muted again. Okay, you're muted again, Ken. I think I was trying to unmute you, and you were doing the same time, and we crossed purposes there. But I'm going to try unmuting you again. Okay, you're okay.
Hopefully, it'll hold this time. So, now we want to thank Barbara for the update, and hope that she will keep us apprised if anything else shows up along those lines. And thank you all for your questions. And now we want to take a look at now it's time for announcements. So if anybody has announcements other than the ones that have already been made, feel free to introduce them at this time. Anybody got one?
I do have an important announcement, a follow-up, and then that's all. Mm-hmm. And that is, I can't remember who it was, I think Carl, who suggested that the possibility of writing to the U.S. attorney. I hope you don't do that, Carl. Please, anything that you would propose to send directly to the U.S. attorney's office or any of those listed in the attorney's U.S. attorney's letter, please run it by Nick Harrison first. You don't
want to
cross purposes to us.
Barbara, I'm a retired federal agent. I've been in grand juries. I've dealt with prosecutors a lot. It could be helpful to have information coming from multiple directions to a prosecutor. So, yeah, I appreciate your thoughts, but...
I understand that. I'm just requesting that you run the contract by Nick.
Not necessary to lecture.
Thank you. You got
well,
my request.
I think since Barbara is...
Yeah, you just need to stay with announcements here. Any other announcements?
Yes, Carl Golder, I have one.
Yes, go ahead, Carl.
Well, among my interests have been constitutional monetary issues. For 5 years, I've attended the Cato Institute in Washington's Monetary Policy Conference every November. Now, this year, I was banned from the conference. And the reason for that is because about 6 months before, I recommended a book to the head of the Monetary Policy Group. It's titled A History of Central Banking and the Enslavement of Mankind by Stephen Mitford Goodson, G-O-O-D-S-O-N, who himself had been an officer of the Central Bank of South Africa. It's a highly informative book covering 2,000 years of bank history, very readable. But apparently the control group at Cato has branded the author Goodson as anti-Semitic. And apparently anyone who finds what he writes about central banking of interest is painted with the same brush. So it's, I think, a book that merits reading by all.
Okay, since that was an announcement, if you would care to send the book's title and author the publishing information to Craig, we can include it in the minutes, okay?
Okay, we'll do.
But, yeah, wow. Here we go again, huh? Okay, and...
My response was I am used to holding a sign in front of places as a form of peaceful petition. And I actually, when I was notified 2 days before the conference, I was not going to be allowed. I actually had a 2x3 foot display sign made up depicting the cover of the book. And when they actually did have security refuse to allow me to go to the registration desk and retrieve my registration package, I spent the next 6 hours holding the displaying the cover of the book outside Cato. I think the only person who has ever figuratively protested at the Cato Institute. So everyone attending the conference got a good look at the book and a brief explanation of the situation.
Okay. All right. Any other announcements?
Can you hear me there? It's Barry Zwicker in Toronto.
Yeah, go ahead, Barry.
Yeah, it's really late, so I'll be very, very short. I'm interested in whether anybody listening knows about an author named Fred Litwin, L-I-T-W-I-N. He's the author of a new book entitled I Was a Teenage JFK Conspiracy Freak. And this Fred Litwin was interviewed on an otherwise excellent current affairs television show called The Agenda on TVO. TVO stands for TV Ontario, a large nonprofit public network. And Mr. Litwin is a grown-up freak. He interests me, though, for professional reasons. And I wonder if anybody has heard his name or knows anything about him. I can give you my email address if you'd like to share anything that way.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you send your email address to Craig, we'll put it in the minutes along with your request, and if anyone reading the minutes can respond, they can do so, okay?
Sure. Good.
All right. Any other announcements?
Yeah. Malcolm Arnold. Given the discussion as far as the Cato Institute Monetary Policy Conference, I've always wanted to go to that, but have never gone to that. I've gone to other conferences of that type. There is a conference coming up December 14th and 15th at Harvard Law School, Money as a Democratic Medium. And anybody who studies monetary policy and the Federal Reserve and stuff like that, you have basically those who think that the government should be in charge of printing money. And that actually, when you study that issue, I'm of the opinion that it just basically gives more power to those who use the levers of the state to rule. And I think that what this conference is all about is setting the intellectual policy that when the economic system that we're currently in collapses, that where it goes to in the future. And I think that it's a very important, I've gone to these type of conferences at Harvard or Yale, and they basically are forecasting the academic rhetoric that will be used in the coming years for where they want to take policy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other announcements? All right. And that brings us to our last item on the agenda. Does anyone have any ideas that we can carry along for future agenda items on our teleconference? Anybody have any good ideas?
Yes, I'd like to propose Major Ralph Gannis.
Mm-hmm. And you would be a good contact person for him. So perhaps...
Did I ask him? And if so, for what call?
Good question. Cheryl would answer that.
Yeah, the next call is on December 26th, and we have one speaker already reserved, and that's Peter Phillips to talk about his new book, Science. So,
I couldn't hear you. Who's the speaker in the topic already?
It's going to be Peter Phillips, talking about his new book, Giants, the Global Power Elite. Yeah. So he's confirmed, and we're looking for one more. So if Yannis wanted to come on then, that would be good.
All right. I'll let you know in the next 48 hours.
Okay.
That should be soon enough. Okay. Any other proposed folks we could have on the teleconference to make it interesting? Anybody have any other thoughts?
Could I ask a question? Did I hear correctly that the next teleconference is on Christmas night, December 25th?
No, it's the next day.
Tonight, no, it's the night after Christmas.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, we wouldn't do that. No.
Okay.
Some things are sacred, okay? All right, anything else?
I have something if you could hear me.
Yep,
can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, great. This is Allison Menard, and I'm sorry that I came in late, but I just wanted to respond to Barbara Honegger's question about how to protect against the backlash, a backlash against Jews if the Israeli terrorist connection is exposed to 9/11. And I just wanted to say that, hello?
Yeah,
can you hear
we're
me?
Not on there right now. We're
did everybody else use? Did somebody bought a...
We're taking suggestions for future teleconference speakers or ideas. Okay, is that what you wanted to talk about? Huh.
Allison, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
So is that what you wanted to – do you have an idea for that, Allison?
I do. Unfortunately, my audio is getting really broken up, but the idea was just P-TECH. You know, there's this computer expert in Dhairya Singh who talked about this Israeli-run company that purports to be run by Arabs. And Christopher Boleyn has talked about a lot in his book, Solving 9/11, that P-TECH had access to the computers of all the federal agencies on 9/11. Mm-hmm. So I think P-TECH is worthy of of investigation.
Okay, but did you have a speaker in mind, a particular person who could speak to that with expertise?
Well, this Indira Singh, but I've heard she went underground.
Yeah, she's underground. I don't think anybody knows how to contact her. We've discussed that before. Nobody seems to know how to get in touch with her.
Yeah, even Bonnie Faulkner, who interviewed her for her show a couple of times, great shows, by the way, mm-hmm. Bonnie cannot get in touch with her now.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, she's pretty deep underground. Christopher Boleyn has made the connection that what Indira Singh thought was an Arab-run company is in fact Israeli-run.
Right. So, and we've had Chris on the show before, so the possibility is to get Chris to come back and talk about PTEC in particular. So I guess we can take that under advisement, okay?
Thank you.
Okay.
This is Sherry in San Diego. I have a suggestion, I guess, for a speaker that I really loved hearing. I think her name, and Barbara would know, is Sarah Nelson. She spoke on Justice and Focus about
Sarah Nelson is Danny Sheehan's wife.
Yeah.
Yeah, she was. When I heard her speak, that gave me hope about how to rally the troops to support like the Lawyers Committee. So I don't know if that
I'm
would be possible.
You, that's a great idea, Sherry. That is a great idea. If everybody agrees, she's a 40-year friend of mine. I've roomed together with her and Danny and Jane Clark in Rome for a week, and I could ask her for January if you'd like.
Wait. What would be the deep state topic here? The deep state related topic. What would it be?
The deep state related topic is that Sarah Nelson is Danny Sheehan's partner, and she has run the Christic Institute. She runs the Romero Institute, which is its successor here in Santa Cruz, California. She is the one who makes everything succeed in terms of organizing, fundraising, etc. If we're going to succeed as the 9/11 Truth Movement, we have to have all of that, and we don't yet.
Yes. I thought she was so amazing. I just was so uplifted by her energy, her knowledge, her organizational skills that Karen spoke with Kate. She had many all over the country.
You're right.
She was amazing. She was like my mentor. She could be our mentor for how to organize the troops to support the Lawyers Committee. That's what
I
think.
She is my 40-year friend and colleague, and if I'm given the go-ahead, I will ask her.
I would still like it to be a little clearer on what her focus would be. You know, what would she be speaking about or on?
How to rally the
success of the 9/11 Truth Movement from a practical, real world point of view, politically, financially, donors, grassroots organizing.
Okay.
She has done it. And
she's also
a speaker at the 2016 Justice in Focus 9/11 event.
Okay. So practical organization for a 9/11 truth, et cetera. Okay.
So, Barbara, why don't you and I connect after, in the next 2 days and figure out the order of for December or January where we put them, okay, if they're willing to talk.
Okay. Do you want me to ask her or talk to you first?
You can ask them if they're willing. If they're willing to do either date, and we'll figure out where to put them, which month. Okay.
Right, so what you might want to do, is have me invite Sarah and Danny both on the call.
There we go.
They are full partners.
Yeah.
What?
That'd be great.
That would be a great idea. Yeah.
All right. If I have to go ahead to feel them out, I will. Mm-hmm. No point in talking to you, Cheryl, about the details of the timing if they're not willing.
Right, exactly. Ask them, and then we'll figure out where to put them.
This is confidential, everybody. But the reason Danny Sheehan is relevant, Ben, is that this is confidential, all right?
Remember, this is a recorded call.
Well, Danny has been asked to be on the board of the Lawyers Committee. He's considering
right.
Okay. And the fact he was asked to be on the board
before the U.S., just before the U.S. attorney in late October, just before the November 7th U.S. attorney's letter was sent. Now, by the way, many of you may be saying, how come it took 3 weeks or so to put out the press releases and let the world know? The kind of embarrassing answer is that the Lawyers Committee has an official address. So when somebody sends something, you know, from a court, they have to send to the address on record. And that address, I won't go into the details, but it's in Pennsylvania, and it's a friend of somebody on the board. And they were out of town, or they were sick, or, you know, God knows what it was. And so it came to that address. They didn't find it, open the mail for, you know, a week and a half. Then they let Mick Harrison know, and he said, yeah, open it up, read it to me. They accidentally spilled coffee on the letter. So, and then Mick had to clean up the letter electronically, and then he had to get it to the board, and we had to meet and decide what to do. This whole process has taken 3 weeks, and that's why the letter is dated November 7th. And it was, I think it was delivered a few days later, you know, from the post office. And it's taken all this time to let you guys know, but that's the reason.
All right. So does anyone else have any ideas for future teleconference, or should we move to close? Okay. Well, those were some good ideas, giving Cheryl something to work with. And Barb's got her work cut out for her, too, I guess. And we'll see what we can do to come up with a really great teleconference for the next month. So until then, we'll see you. Well, we won't see you until after Christmas, so Merry Christmas, everybody, and we'll see you the day afterwards for our next
teleconference. Yeah, thank you, everyone. Yeah. Thank
you very much, everyone. Merry Christmas. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye, everyone.
Likewise.
Thank you.
And a successful new year.
Yes.
Oh,
okay, Ken, is it set up?
Yeah, wait, we're still recording.
Oh.